All right, so we are now beginning session two of the Holy Family. I'm not sure how we're going to fix the fact that we had a snow day last week. We'll have to mash two days together, or we'll be in the Old Testament here for a little while. Maybe I can hurry through some of the patriarchs or something like that and mix them together. But we definitely can't hurry through the session we have today, which is concerning the first family, Adam and Eve. And Lord willing, we'll get also to Cain and Abel. And if we've got enough time, we'll get to Lamech, which is you'll see how things sort of descend from the initial problem with Adam and Eve until when you're talking about the situation with Lamech, it's gotten seemingly as bad as it can get. But you know how the Old Testament is. If you think it's as bad as it can get, keep reading. It gets worse. So we begin today session two of the Holy Family. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, who has committed to thy holy church the care and nurture of thy people, enlighten with thy wisdom those who teach and those who learn, that rejoicing in the knowledge of thy truth, they may worship thee and serve thee from generation to generation, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. All right, so we begin with creation and the creation of Adam and Eve. Sometimes when I'm teaching a Sunday school course, people ask, is there a book? Are we going through a book? Not really. And sort of you could say not at all. But portions of this book have been sponsored by Scott Hahn and a book entitled First Comes Love. The subtitle is Finding Your Family in the Church and the Trinity. So there are some crossover themes between this book and what we're talking about in this course on the Holy Family, and I'll pull quotes here and then. When we get closer to the discussion of marriage in general, there's another Scott Hahn book about marriage, and I think it's called The First Society, the Society of the Husband and the Wife, and we're right back in Adam and Eve. We'll draw from that book a little bit too. So when I draw from a book, I'll try to let you know what it is and where you could get it. Amazon. So you can get Scott Hahn's book, First Comes Love. But let's begin with a quotation about Adam and Eve from Scott Hahn's book. Adam is the name of an individual, but it is more too. Adam is the Hebrew word for humanity. This is something, this is a little explanation. This is something like the way that Americans use the name Washington to mean the first president of their country, the capital city of their country, and the government of their country. Washington, Washington, Washington. Washington's story is, in a sense, America's story. But Adam's story is even greater than that. It belongs to all the nations of the world and to everyone. We'll return to that in just a moment because that sounds wonderful until you hear what happens with Adam. And then you find out that this is your story. Ooh, my story? I don't know about that. Well, we'll ask a question, preparing you for it now. How is Adam's story our story? But nevertheless, it's important to grasp that in this ancient Hebrew writing, the book of Genesis, it should not be lost the fact that the word Adam means humanity. Okay, so we move on. Speaking of the pinnacle of creation, God created humans last of all his creation as head and overseer, image and likeness of God. And only then is all creation called very good. Things are called good and good and good and good. And some people say only the creation of humanity was very good. No, no. Only when the human was created to oversee all of creation was the whole creation called very good. In other words, we're done. We've got this entire creation and we've created man in our image and likeness to rule over and oversee and have dominion over all this creation. Now It is very good. So don't be mistaken that only humanity is very good. No, no, the whole thing is good when it's all together, including the overseer, which is another word for bishop, by the way. Nevertheless, we won't go there. Then the story of the creation of woman emerges. Now, in Genesis chapter 1, it simply goes past and says, and he created man and woman. But by the second chapter of the book of Genesis, it's the focus is basically a recapping of the creation narrative with a focus on what's going on with humanity itself. And so when the story is slowed down in Genesis 2, the story of the creation of woman emerges, where the rationale of the Creator God is that here's Adam in this garden alone. He's not alone. There's puppies, there's kittens, there's, you know, pomegranate trees, there's, you know, birds, but there's a real sense in which it doesn't matter how many gardens and plants and puppies you surround yourself with, you're alone. Unless you have one who is bone of your bone, flesh of your flesh. And so it is not good for him to be alone. Let us create woman. I'm not quoting directly, but here I am. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. So in other words, each one is in a real sense a part of the other. And Adam says, almost in an outburst of relief, finally, here's one that I could be a friend with. Here's one that we can go to Starbucks together and just spend an hour and just chill. You know, these monkeys and orangutans and giraffes, it's just not the same. It's true. It's just not the same, is it? It's an interesting thing, as Scott Hahn points out, I'll just read. For the creation of all the rest of the world, he had merely to issue his fiat. He said, let there be, let there be. But when the time came to make man, God, who is indivisibly one, began to refer to himself in the first person plural. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. The tone changes, the verbalization changes. There's something different about this element of creation. There's something both plural and one about this new element of creation, this overseer, this one who's to have dominion. And that is where we're going to build something on that. Scott says, or Mr. Hahn, probably a doctor, says a little bit later on, the human creature must be a family before it can be fully God's image. Alone, he could not fulfill his purpose in creation. For God is not solitary, so man could not be solitary. And a person who's single their whole life may say, oh, great, so I'm not a part of, you know. No, no, no. If you were born, you're in, okay? If you were born, then you're part of a family, and that's what we're talking about. There's a plurality in that unity. And so the human creature, God creates man, he's alone in the garden, and God says, this is, for the first time, not good. And what's not good? Not the man. It's not good that he is the only one. There needs to be more than one in order for family to exist. Now he's in our true image and likeness. There's a family, there's a relationship. For God is indivisibly one and yet plural. If you want to hear more about that, stick around for the sermon today, because we're going to talk about that a little bit later. And those of you who heard it already, just don't say anything. Plural God, imaged by plural humanity. And so the first family in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve are created in the image and likeness of God. Imagio Dei is what theologians and the church has always used as a term to describe that or to refer to that. They are given dominion over all creation, and they're told to be fruitful and multiply. God says, essentially, I've given you everything. Enjoy. That's a pretty good deal. And if you know what? I've referred to it, so I'm going to actually read you the passage. so that you can hear what Eden was meant to be like. Genesis chapter 1, verse 28 through 30, he says, or the scriptures say, "And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over all the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, Behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat." Maybe you'll recall in the New Testament the return of the prodigal son. When the elder brother is upset about the return of the prodigal son, and there's something that the father says to the elder brother, isn't there? "My son, you are always with me, and all I have is yours. Why are you upset? Everything I have is given to you, and you're always with me. Where's the problem?" You could have said the same thing to Adam and Eve. "Everything I have is yours, and you're always with me. Is there a problem?" Well, let's see if there's a problem. Adam is not to subdue Eve. Adam and Eve are to subdue creation, have dominion. And Eve is not to oversee Adam, but together they are to replenish the earth. And so we say, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes the fall. Sorry. Yeah, there's a Cain and Abel in a baby carriage are coming, but there's something that happens before then, which is the fall. And this is something to really consider, because we say, oh yeah, the fruit in the garden, you know, blah, blah, blah. You understand? And for some reason, we think it's an apple. I don't know where that came from, but it just says fruit. But this is really deep. This is something else. The serpent is subtle, and we ask ourselves immediately, where did the serpent come from? Why is there a serpent? Did God create a serpent and put him in the Garden of Eden? It just doesn't say. So just roll with it for now. You can go to Revelation if you want a clearer answer. The serpent is subtle, but he misleads one who seems to be ready to be misled. I mean, just itching to be misled. You think about that elder brother, right? "All I have is yours, and you're always with me. What's the problem?" Ooh, he's got a problem. I don't know what it is, but he just wants some of this for himself. My brother got it for himself. Why can't I have it for myself? It's in there, isn't it? Pretty deep. For all those who've ever pronounced the word misled, misled, have you ever done that? One who was ready to be misled, misled. And so he lies and says, well, first of all, he asks a misleading question. Isn't that something? Is it true that God told you not to eat of any of the trees of the garden? Who said that? Nobody said that. And she has to clarify. And says, no, actually, that's not right. You misheard, as if you misheard. And says, it's just this one tree. And he says, oh, no. It's not the tree that will cause you any trouble. It'll cause God trouble if you eat from this tree, because it'll be like him. He lies. And she ends up questioning not only God's honesty, but Adam's role as a leader, because the verse just prior, in chapter 2, the verse just prior to the creation of Eve, the rules of the garden were told to Adam. The rules of the garden weren't told to Eve, they were told to Adam. So he is the one who's communicated to Eve. And now that the serpent's telling her a new story, she questions not only God, but her husband, Adam. He doesn't seem like a liar, but I suppose he probably did. And God doesn't seem like someone, but he probably is. And who can you trust in the end? Yourself, right? And so she says, I think I'll trust myself. Eve believes the serpent instead of God and instead of her husband. And then Adam follows Eve. Okay, and now the created order is backwards and upside down. Okay, there was a hierarchy, There was God, and there was his creation, and there was man, and there was woman. And now, after this, God has been placed under Adam and Eve has taken the place of Adam, and Adam has taken the place of Eve, and everything's upside down and backwards. Deacon Josh.
I've heard it said, and this seems to me to believe, it's almost that Adam's job is to protect his wife, and shepherd her and guide her.
Yeah.
So there's really a failing in the vocation of Adam as husband, protector, and leader.
That's my next question. How many things can you think of just went wrong here? Adam abdicates his role as leader. His wife tells him, God lied to you. And he says, okay. No, dummy. You say to her, no, he didn't lie. You've been deceived. Instead of doing that, he says, that sounds good to me. So he has now abdicated his role, and he has now been a failure in his position. And I've already told you, everything's now completely and exactly backwards and upside down in the Garden of Eden. And the serpent knew it, because he went right to Eve instead of to Adam. He went to Eve. So there's something off here. But why is this Adam's fault? Anyone? Deacon Josh just sort of hinted at it. Anyone, am I missing anything about this? You know that in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the fault is placed on Adam. And this is Adam's fault. You know, someone who is reading this less carefully might say, well, it's actually not Adam's fault, you know. Eve is the one. She's the one. No, it's Adam's fault. He had a role. He abdicated his role. He gave up his role. And he actually buckled at the knees and began to believe a lie that started somewhere else, that God was the liar.
I've heard it. This is actual speculation, but other people say that Adam had stayed steadfast.
Yeah.
The human race would not have fallen. Even if Eve had kind of like questioned the authority, Adam had stood his ground and said, no, we're not going to do that. The fall would have been averted. But the fact that he didn't stand his ground.
There's really nowhere to go with a hypothetical about Eden. There's nowhere to go. There's just what is. And so you read it and you say, Adam is humanity. This is where we're going with this. Adam is humanity. Adam and Eve is humanity. And so in what ways is this story of Adam and Eve the story of all humanity? And, well, I could hand you the answer as I'm prone to do. In what ways is this story of Adam and Eve the story of all humanity? Well, the Lord tells you something, and you just don't believe it. Just says something to you like, I will provide. And you say, I think you won't provide. I think I have to do this myself. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I think you're going to leave me and forsake me, and so I better take care of this myself. Any number of things. We'll get deeper into this, but if you read the book of Proverbs, you know, you see we're instructed to cry out for wisdom and pursue wisdom. You have to believe wisdom when wisdom tells you something. For instance, what's about to be told to Cain. If you do well, the Lord will be pleased with you. If you do not do well, sin is waiting for you at your door. Do you believe that or no? And Cain doesn't believe it either. And I think we got two hands. Bob and Michael. Let's go, Bob.
This initial, everything got turned upside down.
Reversal, yeah.
Everybody's mistrusting God. I mean, not everybody. But
right.
In general, that's the way we are. And
in general.
It's reflected in all of our relationships with everybody else. I mean, we just, you know.
Well, we can easily blame it on someone else, and we can easily say it's an Old Testament problem or something. If you want examples of it, we're about to get into the Old Testament in the next few weeks, and you'll see how God has said something to people. They believed it for about 15 minutes, And then they started acting like they didn't believe it, and then it's a whole moral slide sometimes for centuries as a result. Go in and take the promised land, I'll be with you. They go to the promised land and they see it's too hard, and they come back and say, we can't do it. And the result is 40 years in the desert, and a whole generation passes away, and then they take the promised land. Yeah, 40 years is a long time. But the same lesson is there. And Michael, you had something.
How do you respond to people, and I've heard this discussion, that the tree, the apple in the tree represents things where Adam and Eve were not ready for yet, that all of that would have been revealed to them in time, but by hurrying up everything, they just really made a mishmash.
I agree with that, because if you look at the nature of that tree, I think I got one more here. The nature of the tree, what's the name of the tree that God gives it? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Why would God want to withhold from you the knowledge of good and evil? It doesn't make any sense that he would withhold that, except that, you know, you look at King Solomon. King Solomon is granted a wish in a dream, and he wishes for not power, not riches, not, you know, 500 wives or something like that. He says, just give me wisdom, the wisdom to discern between good and evil. And God is so pleased and so impressed that he gives him everything else that he might want anyway. That's the same God that didn't want Adam and Eve to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil just yet. You could say, you know, well, there was no evil yet, and so that was a part of it. But anyhow, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I think that, you know, like, yeah, I would say I don't disagree.
As I understand it, we get misled by the actual words good and evil, but it's a Hebrewism. Just to move, say everything from A to Z.
Everything from A to Z.
Everything from A to Z means he knows everything. So when God says this is the knowledge of good and evil, he's saying this is the knowledge of everything. And if you look later in Genesis, what happens when people get technology or more knowledge? They misuse it.
Yeah, that's good. But you could see how the nature of the taking of that fruit is a grasping
right. Outside
of God. I'll do this by myself. In fact, I'll gain an advantage by taking this for myself. That mentality is the nature of the fall. I'll do this on my own, and I'll do better than God would ever do it, and watch me. That's the nature of it. Joe.
How would you say that in terms of modern day situations, man wants to rely upon man's thought, man's wisdom.
Oh, yes.
Science. We want to worship and rely upon science rather than
It's absolutely the drift of humanity until we come into an age which we call the Enlightenment, where we now see the church fathers as the church children, and we see the medievalists as the church adolescents, and we see ourselves as the church adults. Now that we've been enlightened, all the names that we give for the ages that we're in, some of us have read, I know, Michael, you read through Origen's First Principles somehow from cover to cover, and you find that it's not actually that they were unwise 18 centuries ago. We're having struggling to understand their thoughts now that they were thinking back then, you know? So I got to move on. Did you have another comment?
Yeah, when you get to science in the Bible, I read something just recently, and I make this quick, where they did some studies, they took participants, and they talked about it is better to give than to receive.
Right.
Science has proven that.
It's actually better for you. Yeah.
Physiologically, yeah. What on your being, you get more benefit by giving than you do receiving.
Right.
And I thought all science is doing is reaffirming what we've already been.
But I bet you that if you went back to the Garden of Eden and found, I bet you could do a scientific study to prove that people who trusted only in scientific understanding did worse health-wise than someone who had a faith. That there were things outside my understanding that I can place my faith in and rest in. I bet you scientifically you could prove that those... In other words, we're back in the book of Genesis anyway, even with the science. We're going to do Cain and Abel. So the last sort of comment here was, you know, it's terrible what happened to Adam and Eve. Perhaps their children will do better. And this is the first scene of their kids. Well, I don't even... Okay, so you've had sibling rivalries, but nothing like this, I'm telling you. Cain is born first, and then Abel. Cain is a tiller of the land. Abel is a shepherd. Cain offers to God from his field. Abel offers the firstlings of his flock, and God respects Abel's offering and not Cain's. Why? Doesn't say. You can hypothesize. You can, you know, think about it. You can say, well, it was the blood of the animal, or, but you know, Cain was a tiller of the ground. This was the fruit of his labor. There was something off about Cain's offering. Sorry, it just doesn't say what was the problem with Cain's offering. Doug.
Possibility. Let's
possibility.
Reach into the cause.
Okay.
Maybe Cain offered the leftovers.
I know, but you have to admit it doesn't say.
You have to
hypothesize.
But
it just says there was something, and I almost feel like it's left out on purpose, because you know when you're offering. You know when you're offering the leftovers and the broken thing and the trash and the garbage. And if you spell it out and say, well, it's because he gave the sorry-looking corn, you could say, oh, well, I never give sorry-looking corn, so I'm okay. No, he just says it wasn't acceptable. Ugh. Now, there is no creation narrative for the siblings, as there was for Adam and Eve, but these are definitely Adam and Eve's kids, okay? And why would I say that? Well, let's look at Genesis 4, chapter 6 through 8. And the Lord said unto Cain, why art thou wroth? And why is thy countenance fallen? Seems like a rhetorical question. But he lays out a principle, not unlike what you'd find in Genesis in earlier chapters when he's speaking to Adam and Eve. If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if... He didn't tell Cain that he's damned forever. He says, just do well and you'll be accepted. If thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire. Speaking of sin, sin will be desiring you and pursuing you at all times at your door if you do not do well. And thou shalt rule over him is translated differently in different texts. Basically, the fight is going to be between you and sin now. You're going to be wrestling with sin all the time. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother. So let's see how well Cain took the word that was given to him in the verse before. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. These are Adam and Eve's kids, okay? Because Adam and Eve were told something by the Lord, and they didn't believe it, and went their own way. And then their kids come along, and their son says, hears directly from the Lord, and says, if thou doest well, you will be accepted. And he says, I don't care. I'm so sick of my brother. I'm just going to go out in the field and take care of him. He didn't believe. It's a family tradition. Okay. And that's Hank Williams Jr. And if you know the song, it's a family tradition. If you don't know it, you got to look it up. Anyway, people were giving Hank Williams Jr. a hard time about drinking and singing all night long. And he said, look, have you ever heard of my father, Hank Williams? You know what he used to do? Drink and sing all night long. It's a family tradition. So anyway, a bit of a joke there. But both stories of first parents and first children involve disbelief in what God says. If you eat of the tree, you will die. And the answer, no, I won't. Okay. If you do not do well, sin will wait at your door. No, it won't. This is Cain's response. This is Eve's response and Adam's response, and Abel doesn't get a chance to respond. And so we continue as we look at the descendants of Cain. One key descendant of Cain is the figure Lamech, and we find that in this sin, in this family tradition of sin, there is a constant recurrence of role reversals. Roles are being reversed. Okay? Cain is exiled and he says, this is too awful, I can't be exiled like this, people are going to kill me as soon as they see me. He's given a mark so that he will not be killed, and God says, okay, I will avenge sevenfold anyone who touches Cain, anyone who kills Cain, sevenfold. Very good. Cain's descendant Lamech then is the first to take two wives, interestingly enough, two wives. You'll hear more about that. Well, some of that in the sermon here this morning about marriage. And he also says, after having taken two wives, I have killed a man for insulting me, and whoever hurts me, if you thought Cain would be avenged sevenfold, whoever hurts me will be avenged 70 and sevenfold. There's some massive role reversals going on here. You can see it again. Rather than follow God, Lamech tries to be God. Okay, God is the one that says, I will avenge sevenfold. And Lamech says, that sounds good to me. I will speak in the voice of God and I will double down. He's taking the role of God because he is going to, first of all, reinvent marriage. Because marriage is now polyamorous and we can have as many wives as I want. First one to do that. And he also says, I will reinvent and I will say myself, not God, who will surely die. God speaks to Adam in the garden, says, if you eat of this tree, you will surely die. Lamech says, oh, I like the way that sounds. God rolls pretty big. I'm going to talk like that too. I'll be like God. Anyone who touches me will surely die. Role reversal. The nature of sin is taking God out of his position and putting yourself in, taking the words of God and putting them in your mouth and changing them to your own benefit. Lamech is there's two Lamechs in the Old Testament, so don't get confused. By the way, these are his two wives. They seem to be pulling his hair. I don't know. But anyhow, how can a broken family like this be restored? You've heard St. Augustine's quote, the Old Testament is the new concealed. The New Testament is the old revealed. And so as we're, you know, you say, well, we don't even need the old. Who is the pastor that not long ago said we don't need the Old Testament anymore? We can set the Old Testament aside. All we need is the New Testament and basically just bits and pieces of the New Testament. And I want to say it was Charles Stanley's son, Andy.
It was.
Andy Stanley said we don't need the Old Testament anymore. And my head, I had to hold it together so it didn't explode. Yes, you need the Old Testament, okay? Because how will we understand Christ? Christ is going to, for us, in a sense, restore Eden. And he says words like these, my food is to do the will of my Father. Consider the forbidden fruit, okay? If Adam and Eve had taken that attitude, my food is to do the will of my Father, and my Father says, everything I have is yours, and you're always with me. Just don't eat of this tree. Jesus comes, and he fixes it in himself. He says, my food is to do the will of my Father. And you can offer me something forbidden, but I guarantee you I won't take it. That's a restoration. Restoration in a sense of Eden. Think about Cain and Abel. Cain's jealousy of Abel's good works because he wanted his works to be better than Abel's and Abel to die for his, you know, miserable superiority to me. Jesus says of those who believe in him, the works I do, you will do also, and greater works than these because I go to the Father. The Lord is willing to share his ministry with others and even say, you will do greater works than these because I go to the Father. That is a repairing of that sibling relationship between Cain and Abel. He says to his apostles, I call you friends now because I let you know what I'm doing. And he ordains them to go out and continue his ministry. And he prays for them that their works would be even greater than the works that he... There's no Cain in that. He's repairing that family relationship, that broken family relationship. And now you consider Lamech's rivalry with God. He says, I will take two wives, and not only that, anyone who hurts me will be avenged 77-fold. Jesus says, when St. Peter comes to him and says, how many times must I forgive? Seven, which was generous because it used to be three. And so he thought, seven, is that pretty good? You know, one more than double. And Jesus says something that if you don't know your Old Testament will seem a little bit random. Jesus says, you must forgive 70 times sevenfold. And anyone who knows that story of Lamech will say, whoa, hold the phone. Jesus just took the descendant of Cain and took his pronouncement and didn't just go back and say, let's go back to sevenfold or let's go back. He took it and converted it into forgiveness. Say, you want 70 times sevenfold wrath? How about 70 times sevenfold forgiveness, which is the polar total opposite, the healing, the restoration, and the fixing of a broken family relationship. So how do you fix a broken family? And see, people say, Jesus is the answer for everything, which sometimes doesn't help, but it's actually true. It doesn't help to say, Jesus is the answer to every question. Well, kind of, yeah. But when we're talking about something like this, we're looking at the nature of the fall and the breakup and the brokenness of the first family. It's absolutely true. And if you listen carefully to the words of Christ, he's fixing the family problems of Adam, Eve, and their descendants in his own words. And we're getting to the Holy Family, you see. We'll be getting there all along. And so any questions or comments about our second session here on Adam and Eve? Anything, Mr. Deacon Kimbrell?
So it sounds to me, this is I'm actually taking this from the things first. Adam by himself is an inadequate image of God. It's when Adam and Eve together, they're whole and complete together, that they fully image God.
That is the statement.
So if we were to take that forward into the New Testament, if Christ is the new Adam, does that mean that he needs his body, the church, for the fullness and completeness of his work to be done? So that seems to present a paradox between Christ being solely sufficient, but the church also being part of the equation.
It's not utterly divorced from your original question about what if Eden happened differently. Mm-hmm. There's no hypothetical. What is what is. So Christ is incarnate. He becomes a new Adam. And quite naturally, there's fruit. Because Adam was not sent to be alone in the garden. And so Adam quite naturally needs a bride. And the new Adam gets a new bride right away. And there's fruit in all different directions for all time and eternity. What would have happened if there hadn't been a church? It's like, I don't know. There's no answer to the question, but I mean, it's fun to theorize about it, I suppose, but it's always a theological difficulty to say God needed something, because that doesn't actually make sense to say God needed something. There only is what there is, which is Christ becomes the new Adam, and he becomes the bridegroom, and the bridegroom has a bride, and the bridegroom and the bride bear fruit. That's the plan. He's restoring. He's recapitulating in himself. And now we're out of time, but are there any other... hearing none, we shall adjourn until next week. Farewell.